good morning, everyone. I had wanted to begin by acknowledging this beautiful land that we are on and by thanking the Indigenous women that have come to call the spirits down to bless us. And also to acknowledge Jen and the staff, the Gift Economy Movement, for working so diligently to bring us here so that we can continue this most important and now I will use the term strategic work. And also to recognize and thank the folks from this facility for helping us to get this venue, very nice location for all of us. I wanted also to talk a little bit today about something that was on my mind since the time that we had left Stonehaven a few years ago, and that was the concept of reciprocity. We had talked there about the work that has been evolving here, work that sometimes occurs on this continent, sometimes in other regions, but how can we move ahead in a collective way? How can we prepare a strategy that will address the crisis that confronts all of us, Indigenous peoples and those who are not, crisis that is threatening the survival of the world? And when I reviewed my notes from our discussions at Stonehaven and reviewed some of the articles that had been submitted and read there at Stonehaven, I began to consider what the concept of reciprocity really meant. The paper that I'm delivering here is entitled Indigenous Women and the Gift Economy Movement, a Strategic Partnership in Opposition to Globalization. Reciprocity is a fundamental value in the gift economy. We have spoken about it, we have all written about it. It is also a foundational cornerstone for all of the Indigenous communities of the world. Reciprocity implies that there's an ebb and flow in relationships, a give and take. Reciprocity infers that there's a mutual sharing, something that is given for something that is received. In Indigenous societies, reciprocity is simply the way that things work in society, within the nuclear family, within the extended family framework, and in the relationships not only between and among people, but the relationships between humankind and the rest of God's creation. Reciprocity cannot be defined or limited by the language of the market economy because it implies that more is owed than financial payment. More is owed than financial payment when goods and services exchange hands. Reciprocity is the way of balance. Planting precedes harvesting. Sowing precedes reaping. And when we have reaped the bounty that we have sowed, we then gather up the seeds that we will plant for the coming harvest, so it is circular. In most Indigenous societies, there's a common understanding that is sometimes referred to as the original instructions, the instructions that the Creator gives to all of us. The original instructions tell us that the role of humankind is to act as the guardian for the rest of God's creation. Indigenous peoples and communities know that if we care for, nurture, and preserve the earth, she will feed, clothe, shelter, and heal us. When we look at the concept of reciprocity in the Indigenous community, we see that it is identical with the concept of reciprocity that we are enunciating as we move forward with the development of the gift economy movement. And we see also that the gift economy and the Indigenous way is diametrically opposed to the market economy. The gift economy is collective. The market economy favors individualism. And where you find market economy stretching its analysis to be collective, what you find is that it strays from what is naturally human and what is natural to the earth. because the understanding of market economy collectivism is that it manifests in the form of the joint partnership, the limited partnership, a joint venture. And the corporate collective is not a human thing, it's a legal fiction. President of corporation dies, majority shareholder dies, but corporation continues. It has no beating heart, but exists in the form of bylaws and articles of incorporation that are filed, stamped with the authority of government, and put somewhere in an office. The market economy does not thrive on the bounty as the gift economy does. When there is a bounty, it can be given and shared. This is the way of the gift economy. But in the market economy, price and fiscal value increase as commodities become rare. So we will consume to the point that there is very few of the commodity left. And when the commodity is rare, then the price will shoot up and the value will be increased. When we look also, most importantly, at the values, the activities, and the outcomes that arise from market economy versus gift economy, we can then see what the real conflict is. And I was happy to hear last night one of the speakers present that we must return to take a look at the values that underline what we do. The values underlying the globalized approach are consumption and individualism. The values that underline the gift approach and the indigenous approach are sustainability, preservation, and collectivism. And when you hear those terms, sustainability, preservation, you understand that it speaks to our collective social obligation and responsibility. There is no understanding of the broader social obligation or responsibility that arises out of the capitalist globalized economic system, because the underlying values are individual and consumptive in nature. The activities that arise and that are pursued in the globalized economic market system are industrialized production, globalized marketing, the World Trade Organization, the IMF, and others, and allocation of resources that are based on ability to pay or buy. But the activities that arise from the indigenous economic model, the gifting society, are gifting an exchange, an allocation that is based on a bounty and need. The results that arise from the economic globalized system are profit and debt systems, polarized development, those few that are greatly wealthy, and the vast majority that live in poverty. When we look at the results of the gift economy indigenous approach, here we see the evolution of community development, community advancement. And when we look at the overall practice, which I consider to be something outside the language of the market or gift economy, the practice that we must follow, that we must achieve and pursue in the capitalist and globalized system, the practice, the papa, the foundation, is secularization. But the practice in the gift economy in the indigenous way is spiritualism. Why do I say that the time has come for those of us in this movement to begin to consider and strategize strategic partnership in opposition to globalization? And why do I believe that it will be indigenous women who must come to the forefront now to sit at the table and to work out the strategic partnership? I say this for two reasons. The first is that we're speaking here of a paradigm shift. And we're not speaking of creating something new. We are speaking of returning to the way of balance. We're speaking of returning in a circle to a way of balance that predates and precedes the economic market economy that first came to our shores the colonizers' and discoverers' boats. So we are speaking in a way of returning to our traditional indigenous roots. I also say this because I've come to the understanding and the firm belief that indigenous women, as knowledge holders, as the keepers of certain traditional knowledge systems, are the key partners, because it is they who have preserved this knowledge, knowledge of survival, not only the knowledge of birthing of the children, but the knowledge of healing of the body, and most importantly now, the knowledge relating to the feeding of the family. So we must consider, as indigenous women, how we will work with our indigenous cultures to further this understanding, and the role that we will play as we strengthen the strategic partnership that we have already begun to undertake. In all indigenous cultures, gender roles and responsibilities flow from and are part of the larger socioeconomic and cultural environment. That is to say that indigenous societies, there's a delineation between what women do and what men do. And this is based on cultural protocol and survival needs. The essential feature of any people's sociocultural environment is this concept of meaning. Meaning, whatever its size, complexity, or environment, the central task of any culture is to provide its members with a sense of meaning and purpose in the world. Gender itself is a sociological concept. It encompasses economic, social, and cultural distinctions between women and men, as manifested in their differing roles. In recent times, there arises the understanding that gender roles in indigenous societies decide who in that society, men or women, should be the keeper of traditional knowledge. In traditional societies, women are the keepers of certain knowledge systems, and they make use of different resources, the resources of the earth, than those resources that are used by men. For example, when you look in indigenous cultures, women would be holders of knowledge systems relating to gathering of foods from the forest, to the use of the forest for healing, especially relating to birth, whereas men would be more likely the keepers of knowledge relating to things such as timber, forestry. This understanding arises now in the international arena, and it's quite well documented by studies undertaken by groups such as the Lynx Project in Germany, and also by the United Nations Food and Agriculture Organization, which has documented that throughout the world, it is women who hold and who have maintained the gender-differentiated knowledge systems relating to the conservation, management, and improvement of genetic resources for food and agriculture. This is in the keeping of women. Conservation and the knowledge of conservation has been in the keeping of indigenous women for many generations. Their studies show that rural women farmers and those involved in animal husbandry have accumulated intimate knowledge of their ecosystems, including management of pests, conservation of soil, development and use of plant and animal genetic resources, that their local knowledge is highly sophisticated and is traditionally shared and handed down from generation to generation. In addition, their studies show that through experience, innovation, and experimentation, sustainable practices have been developed by indigenous cultures which protect the soil, water, natural vegetation, and biological diversity of the earth's great bounty. This knowledge has not been lost. This knowledge is preserved and maintained primarily by indigenous cultures, and within those cultures by indigenous women. The UN studies show that 90% of the planting material used by the farmers of the world is derived from seeds and germplasms that they have produced and selected themselves. The 90% is in the underdeveloped South, because the farmers of America, Canada, and Europe are no longer capable of planting crops that will give them seed. They must have capital to purchase the seed that is Roundup ready, that is on the market by Monsanto, that has been genetically modified to accept the pesticide. But the indigenous farmers who are currently feeding 90% of the world, not the indigenous, but the rural farmers, because there's significant numbers of farmers that are not indigenous that also fall into this category, it is they who are capable of planting, harvesting, and bringing forth germplasm and seed that will be ready for the next season. So we see here the critical role that indigenous women are playing in maintaining biodiversity conservation and promoting sustainable development. This is why I believe that in the effort that we are moving forward now for strategic initiatives for gift economy, that we must ourselves begin to put into a framework now a political strategy for bringing indigenous women into this movement and expanding the movement to indigenous peoples globally. We can take a look at many indigenous reports on indigenous peoples to confirm what we're saying, but the truth is that we know in our hearts that this is the case. When we address the strategy to counter globalization, I think that we need to take a look at how communication technology comes into play, because right now communication technologies are being used to further the theft of indigenous knowledge, the privatization through Western intellectual property law systems, patenting, copywriting, not only copywriting of the work that has been written, but the copywriting of the intellectual property of the knowledge systems itself, and thereafter following the patenting of the life forms, the patenting of the plants, the patenting of the animals, and the patenting of human beings, which has already been attempted in the Pacific Basin to patent human beings. So when we look at strategic ways to address globalization, I think we have to address, as a matter of priority, the point that Susan raised last night, addressing the problems with ICTs. The primary elements of the information society are knowledge, information, or data, and communications. Information communication technology, ICTs, are transmission instruments that are being used by modern technological states and corporations to further communication in all areas. This is the cornerstone of what globalization is about. But traditional knowledge, which is the basis of our cultures, is very different. It is based on indigenous concepts, practices, and values, which I had mentioned earlier. It has evolved for centuries within certain socio-cultural environments. In indigenous cultures, the gender roles and responsibilities will determine not only who will be the keeper of the knowledge, but how that knowledge is transmitted. Often in indigenous communities, transmission of knowledge requires a spiritual ceremony, personal soul-searching, commitment, and years of mentoring. In the ICT globalized world, knowledge is taken as a commodity placed on the internet for use of the public domain without the appropriate spiritual, social responsibility context. And because of this, there is not only great strife, but there is great danger. Because when we step back and look at this analysis, we see that there is a critical nexus between preservation of these knowledge systems and the practice, the spiritual practice of passing them generation to generation. What used to be the oral tradition is now destroyed and replaced by the ICT, internet, way of communicating, which is devoid of the knowledge that is passed from a mother to her daughter within the sociocultural context, what it means to fast and pray, to receive great knowledge, and to assume and accept the responsibility of passing that knowledge on to others. So I see that we are now at a position where we can begin to contemplate how we can be more proactive in our work and how we can work within and among our own indigenous communities, with indigenous women taking the lead. It is the appropriate way. This is the appropriate cultural context. And I say this coming from a culture that is matrilineal. So this is the appropriate way that we must proceed. And finally, I wanted to leave you with this idea, this concept, this idea to think about. Because the image that we have followed for many years in our work with the Indigenous Women's Network, and as we've tried to build this partnership, is the image of the pebble cast into the clear, still pond. Because the pebble is a small thing. When it is cast into the clear, still pond, it falls in the center of the pond, but ripples are sent out in concentric circles, and they move until they touch the furthest shore. And that has been the symbol and the picture that we have held in our mind. How do we begin to move this with ourselves, finding and reawakening our spiritual place, with our cultures, maintaining and preserving them? But we cannot just stop there. We must go to the larger community. We have an obligation to address and to confront and challenge the work of the nations. We have an obligation to take it to the furthest shore. And that means in the international arena to address the WTO, the IMF, and others. I was very happy to receive by the email the statements that were taken by the proponents of the gift economy to the Porto Alegre meeting. We need to be there. We need to consider now, is there a way that we can use the Cartagena protocols, the treaty that was passed in the last year and a half that allows nation states to prevent genetically modified foods from entering into their region. We have to protect the food security of the world. It is our obligation. Do we know that in the last 3 months, an international convention on plant genetic resources for food and agriculture was passed? Are we aware of this? This was passed by the FAO, with most of the work being done in the FAO headquarters in Italy. Indigenous peoples, as usual, are left out of the plant genetic treaty, but it does say that the farmers of the world have a right to be in receipt of resources, have a right to have their lands. That means the women farmers of the world have certain rights. The indigenous farmers of the world have certain rights. How can we use this in a strategic way? How can we support and become part of the developing slow food movement, which I recently returned from Turin, Italy, just a few weeks ago. 5,000 delegates came to Turin in the northern part of Italy, in Piemonte region. There, I was shocked to see 5,000 delegates. There was no controversy. There was no disagreement. The podium was shared by speakers as diverse as Vandana Shiva, Winona LaDuke, and following thereafter, Prince Charles. Not someone that I would generally be working with myself, but a slow food movement of people who are organic farmers but who don't see themselves in that way. People who are opposed to the rise of GMOs, but they don't see themselves as GMO activists. People who have come together with a common understanding that the farmers of the world have a sacred obligation to feed the peoples of the world, and to protect the natural bounty of God's creation. 20% of the people there were indigenous peoples. I was there with Native American, North American delegation, Canadians, American Indians, and some from Hawaii, some from the Pacific. But those farmers from Africa, from Kenya, bringing back the drought-resistant seeds, and others from all over Europe. The first time in many, many years that I've been in a global meeting, in a global political meeting, where there was not great anger, enmity, and hatred. This is a movement that I think that we can strategically interface with. And I was very happy to see there our sister Vandana Shiva, who is a member of an international body that has set forth what is called a Manifesto for Food. And it is an analysis that addresses the WTO, the IMF, and all of these corporate powers that are so far from the fields where indigenous women farmers are struggling to plant and maintain the diversity of the great gift that the Creator gives us so that we might persevere and survive in these difficult times. There are many things to do. Some will be called to till the earth and to teach the children within the socio-cultural economic environment. Some will be called to work at the national and regional levels. But my great fear is that we will neglect to develop a strategy at the global level. And we should all be uplifted to know that there are movements that are beginning outside the gift economy. And these are fertile fields where we could sow the seed of understanding of the gift economy, where it will take root. So I want to close by thanking once again those who have brought us here and to challenge people to consider the statements that women are presenting here, not just to leave with some understanding, but to consider now how we might strengthen and develop a global and regional network, because we are called upon to resist, prevent, and strike globalization. And I consider it to be a sacred undertaking and responsibility for all of the Creator's children, those that are indigenous and those that are not. Mahalo.